Lecture 3, Describing Ever More Complex Motion.
Last time we were talking about Galileo's inclined plane experiments. 400 years ago, these beautiful, simple, elegant little experiments of marbles running down a ramp. They're deceptively simple. There's some very big ideas of science that are developing as Galileo is thinking about and articulating what do you need to do such an experiment. Right? He's looking not just at the science, but at the meta-science issues. So you have to make decisions. You have to reduce friction. You have to reduce gravity. You have to think about what measurement tools you're using. You have to come up with some clever timing tools. You are deciding to manipulate nature purposefully in order to learn something about nature rather than just straight observation of the world around you. You're quantifying the data, trying to get numbers that are rigorous. You are being very careful about your definition of words and terminology. You're deciding about units and measures. All of these things are part of the practice of the scientific method, which future scientists appreciated and have used to great power over the years. The result of this experiment was a direct contradiction with Aristotle's writings. Aristotle said very clearly that heavy object and light object, when released and subject to the force of gravity, should—this is not his language, but rephrased in contemporary language—should strike the ground at very different times. The heavy thing should reach the ground first. And so you have to appreciate the huge social implications of demonstrating very clearly, in a way that was easily reproduced, that this is not correct. So you're questioning the wisdom of the ancients and, in fact, demonstrating that it's incorrect. So think about all the ramifications. Think about how uncomfortable this might make a church in that era, which has made certain public statements about how the world works, and in particular about astronomy, which we will be coming back to. So Galileo is certainly on the verge of something very big, and we really haven't talked enough about the results of his measurements. So that's what I want to focus on today. And we're going to start for about the first half of today's lecture with the kinematics alone. Kinematics is the description of the motion. So I would like to think about some of the words that I've been using casually: speed, velocity, acceleration. And we're going to try to define these. We're going to try to understand exactly what we mean by them. We will find that acceleration is the most subtle of all, and it's also the most fundamental. In physics, when you're talking about the rate of change of something, that's a very, very important idea. And we'll see this over and over again in our course. So this is the first important example of a place where a thing and the rate at which that thing is changing are both separately very important. Once we have described the kinematics, once we have been able to define these words, we will discover it's more than just a description. You can predict the future if you know kinematics. Kinematics is velocity, for instance. And if you know velocity, then you should be able to predict where it was before and where it's going to be in the future. So kinematics is already a part of physics, which can be very useful, and it's going to guide us to ideas that are yet more fundamental, because we're going to start asking, yeah, but why? Why is its velocity what it is, and why is it changing the way it is? So that's where we're headed. Let's start with speed. We defined speed last time as the distance you've traveled divided by the time you took. Okay, and if you want to be really careful, let me call this the average speed. Average because I'm measuring your speed over some finite chunk of time. So if you're driving to a destination, if you're driving to grandma's house, what you want to know most likely is your average speed for the trip. You want the total distance and the total amount of time. And it doesn't really matter so much. You're sort of assuming that you'll have some rest stops along the way, you'll speed up, you'll slow down. What you care about is the average. Now, if your average is 60 miles an hour, then that carries a lot of information. If you say it's a steady 60 miles per hour, there's extra information there. So let's think about 60 miles an hour. It's just a, it's already fruitful to analyze such a little simple term. So 60 miles in 60 minutes, that's 1 mile in 1 minute. I've just changed units from hours to minutes. So you can do that anytime you're talking about a physical quantity. I can measure time in hours, minutes, seconds, years, you choose. I can measure distance in miles or feet. So it's just a calculation. If you know how many feet there are in a mile, you pull out your calculator, and I urge you to try this out and check for yourself if 60 miles an hour is 88 feet per second. 88 feet per second means every second, as the clock ticks, you've traveled another 88 feet, or 27 meters. These numbers, of course, you can't compute in your head. You have to have done them on a calculator and remember them. 60 miles an hour is such a common speed that I happen to know those unit conversions. But otherwise, you simply need to know how many meters are there in a mile or how many meters are there in a foot. You look it up. It's human conventions. The word steady carries some information. So if it's a steady 60 miles per hour, it means your cruise control is probably on. And it's 88 feet every second, second after second. And so here's where I'm arguing that knowing kinematics predicts the future. So if you're going a steady 60 miles per hour on the highway with the cruise control on, then you know exactly where you're going to be in 2 hours. Barring some unforeseen change, in 2 hours, you're going to be 120 miles further down the road. And you know how far you're going to be in 10 minutes. 10 minutes is 10 miles if you're going 60 miles per hour. If that went by too fast, think about it, convince yourself. Really, what I'm doing is a little algebra problem in my head, and we're pretty used to that on the highway, right? When you look at the signs, and it's especially easy at 60 miles per hour because it's exactly 1 mile per minute, you can do this in your head. But what you're doing in your head is the algebra problem speed equals distance divided by time. 60 miles divided by 1 hour, that's what you mean by your speed. And Galileo is thinking about speed without using this kind of algebraic relationship. And I'm not quite sure how to think about it in his way, and it's more awkward, so there's probably no need to go back to that old mathematics. Distance divided by time, it's a ratio. I don't think of it as a template to plug numbers into my calculator. It's telling me something. It's what speed is. It's how far you go every second. And the fact that it's a steady 60 miles per hour tells me that the ratio is steady. So if I go for twice as long, I'm going to go twice as far. That's more of a Galilean way of thinking about it. The ratio stays constant. So that's what we mean by speed or average speed. But in physics, we're often interested in what's going on now. Right? What's the instantaneous speed? So what do I mean by that? Well, that's exactly what you're looking at when you're looking at the speedometer. You say, oh, now I'm going 60. Oh, now I'm hitting the brakes. Now I'm going 50. Now I'm going 40. When you say, now I'm going, you're thinking about an instantaneous speed. And when the police officer pulls you over, it's not going to do you any good to say, yeah, but officer, my average speed for this trip was below the speed limit. And the officer will say, yes, but your instantaneous speed was above the speed limit. And they know the difference between instantaneous and average. You can be going 60 miles an hour, and you don't have to go for an hour, right? 60 miles per hour right now just means that if I were to go for an hour, then I would go 60 miles. So it makes total sense to talk about your instantaneous speed, but you have to think carefully about how you would measure that. It's very easy to measure average speed. You just lay out a ruler, you see how far you went, you start that stopwatch, and you end the stopwatch. Average speed is easy to define operationally. But instantaneous speed is a tricky business. So what could I mean by that? Well, let's see. If I'm going 60 miles per hour, what I really mean is let's figure out how far I went in a pretty short amount of time, like 1 second. And if I went 88 feet in 1 second, that's an average speed of 88 feet per second averaged over 1 second. And that's a short enough time that I might say comfortably, okay, I'm going 60 miles an hour. But technically speaking, what you really mean is 60 miles an hour over an arbitrarily short amount of time. So you have to think about taking the limit as you measured over shorter and shorter imaginable times until you've gotten down to some infinitesimal little time. And the way your automobile really does this in practice, the wheel is turning, and in the amount of time it takes your wheel to go around one revolution, that's a very short amount of time. Of course, your automobile knows how big your tire is, and so it knows how far your automobile has traveled. So if you measure the time for the wheel to rotate once, then you can figure out your average speed over that incredibly short amount of time, and that's what the speedometer is reading. Now that we've talked about instantaneous speed, we can talk about the change in that speed. So I can be going 60, and then I can go slower, and then I can go faster. And those words mean something now. Faster means a higher instantaneous speed. Slower means a smaller instantaneous speed. But oftentimes, what you care about in real life is how rapidly are you going from fast to slow, or from slow to fast. So think about the difference between a fancy little sports car sitting at the edge of the road on the on-ramp trying to get on the highway and an old VW microbus. Okay, each one of them is at rest. Each one of them wants to be going 60 miles per hour, which is the flow of traffic on the highway, and they're going to do it in a different way. Okay, so let's think about this sports car. You jam on the gas, and in 3 seconds, whoo, you're up on the highway at 60 miles per hour. Okay, that's a spectacular change in your speed in a very short amount of time. So this distinction between how fast you're going and how rapidly your speed is changing, it may seem obvious, and then it's one of those ideas that's going to slip away. So we're going to keep talking about the rate of change of something, because it's absolutely critical that we distinguish between how fast you're going and how rapidly you're changing your speed. If you stop, then the difference between a rapid acceleration and a slow acceleration, a large or small acceleration, is going to be humongous. So acceleration is going to be defined as the rate of change of speed. That is to say, how much faster did I go divided by how much time did it take me? The rate at which the speed is changing is the acceleration. So how are we going to measure that? What kind of units would we use? It's not miles per hour. That's speed. And I'm talking about how rapidly did you change? So for instance, for that sports car, it might be miles per hour per second. Let's think about it. We went from 0 to 60, so that was a change in speed of 60 miles per hour, and it took us 3 seconds. So it took us 3 seconds to change by 60. That means 60 divided by 3, we were changing by 20 miles per hour every second. And that is the acceleration. 20 miles per hour per second would be the acceleration of a very, very good sports car. Okay, so 20 miles per hour per second, what does that mean? Well, after 1 second, how fast is that sports car going? It started at 0, now it's going 20. 1 second later, it's now going 40. 1 second later, now it's going 60. 0, 20, 40, 60 miles per hour. Every second, it's increasing by another 20. Okay, what about the VW microbus? So let's suppose it takes it a minute to get up to highway speeds. Okay, so you're chugging away, and there's a little bit of a headwind, and maybe you're going up the hill. So your acceleration would be 60 miles per hour divided by 60 seconds. So not 20 like the sports car, but in this case, 1 mile per hour per second. So each second, the VW microbus is going 1 mile per hour faster. Now, they both started at rest, and they both ended up going 60 miles an hour on the highway. So the fact that they have very different accelerations, one of 20 in these units and one of 1 in these same units, doesn't tell me about where they started or what they ended up at. It just tells me about the rate. So this distinction between the speed and the rate of the change of the speed, it's a tricky business. So if I tell you I've got a motorcycle and I'm on it and, you know, I'm speaking on my cell phone, this would be really dangerous on a motorcycle, and I say, my motorcycle is got a huge rate of acceleration right now. Okay, am I going fast? You have no way of knowing, right? I'm telling you that I'm accelerating rapidly, but I might be telling you that just the moment that I started, I might be accelerating at 20 miles an hour per second, but I've only been accelerating for a half a second, and so I'm not really going fast yet. Or I might be telling you after 3 or 4 seconds, and then I really am going fast. So knowing my acceleration all by itself, knowing my acceleration now, does not tell you my speed now. The two things are connected, right? Once you know one, it helps you figure out how the other one is changing over time. If I'm on my bicycle and I'm going 20 miles per hour, that's a moderate rate of speed on a bicycle. And if I stop gently, so I touch the brakes a little bit, and maybe it takes me 20 seconds to cruise to a stop because I see that stop light coming up, that's very relaxed. I can feel that rate of change. Your body is able to detect accelerations. Now imagine that I go from that exact same starting speed, 20 miles per hour, and I go to that exact same final speed, zero, but this time I do it in a millisecond. How would you do that? You'd have to run into a parked car. Ouch. And if you run into a parked car, that exact same starting and ending speed has a very, very different feel to it. You've got broken bones. It's a bad story. Acceleration is a much, much larger number in that case. It's negative because my speed went down instead of going up. And it's the change in speed, negative 20 miles per hour, divided by the amount of time taken. If it was 1/1,000th of a second, 20 divided by 1/1,000th is 20,000 miles per hour per second. And that's the kind of acceleration that breaks bones. The Aristotelian language, fast or slow, was vague. It was inadequate. In order to carefully describe a marble rolling down a ramp, we're back to Galileo, because Galileo is really the one who's figuring out this story. He recognized the need to distinguish between how fast is the marble going and what's its acceleration or rate of change. Because as you watch a marble go down a ramp, it starts at rest, and then it rolls slowly at first, and then faster and faster and faster, it speeds up. Indeed, what Galileo observed was that there was a constant or steady acceleration. So every second, the speed would increase by the same amount, second after second after second, for a given incline. And it didn't matter if he used a heavy or a light marble, but it did matter what the angle of the incline was. If you make the ramp steeper, it should be obvious, and it's quite correct, that the marble will accelerate more rapidly. So Aristotle might have said, how fast is the marble going? And that's a nonsense question. It's not a sensible question, because I would say, how fast is it going when? When it started, they're all going zero. Right? The question would really be better phrased as either, what's the speed at a particular instant in time? What's the instantaneous speed? But you'd really like to know that over a bunch of different instants of time, and that's what the acceleration is telling you. Aristotle didn't even think about this distinction, and this is one of the great discoveries of rolling little marbles down an inclined plane. Language matters. In physics, we're often using words that are English language words. I talk about speed, and you know what that means, and velocity and acceleration. And in English, the word acceleration can sometimes be used synonymously with speed, if you're being very casual. But physicists get very uncomfortable when you do that, because to me, acceleration means a totally different thing. And so throughout this course, we're going to try to be very careful when we use physics words to define them, hopefully in an operational sense. So I tell you what set of measurements would you need to make. To measure speed, you have to take a very short amount of time and measure the distance traveled. Then you do it again a well-measured time later, and now you've got a change in speed and a change in time. Okay, so in principle, once we've got this kinematics, once we can describe instantaneous speeds and accelerations, then we've got a very powerful tool to predict the future. So if I know how rapidly a marble is accelerating down a ramp, I can predict not only how fast it's going to be going a second from now or 2 seconds from now, but I can even work out where it is, because the acceleration over time, really, that's acceleration multiplied by time, if you're thinking about the math. Acceleration occurring over some time period will give you a change in speed. And if you think about what speed means, that's telling you the change in position over time. And so you put this all together. The math is not so hard, and it's one of the things that we work on in a more traditional, mathematically focused introductory physics classes, working out where's the marble at various times. Police are very good at this, by the way. They can look at an accident. They look at the tracks, the skid marks on the highway, and they can make predictions or calculations working backwards in time. So they look at the final state, and they are able to calculate how fast were you going before the crash to decide whether they should give you a ticket. We'll have to talk more about that later in this course. So let me wrap up what I might call the first part of Galileo's marble experiment. The first part was pure kinematics. We've thought about acceleration and velocity. We've distinguished them. We've recognized that heavy and light marbles all have the same acceleration as they roll down the ramp. And I haven't explained any of this. I'm just describing it. This is the way nature is. These are useful constructs in order to describe what's going on. Okay, now comes another part of Galileo's marble experiment. And this one, I'm not 100% sure if he did it or if he just thought about it. So you can talk about a thought experiment in physics, and it's just something where that's all you need to do. So sometimes those old Greek philosophers were on the right track. You can think about what should happen. Of course, in the end, you better try the experiment and make sure. So you've got this down ramp. The marble speeds up, and at some point, the ramp runs out, and so now the marble is running across the flats. And now imagine that you add an up ramp on the other side. So it goes down, goes across, goes back up again. Okay? So what's going to happen? Well, we've got some description of the motion, and we know that as it rolls down the ramp, we can describe it now. As it rolls across the flats, we can describe it now. As it rolls up the other side, we can describe how rapidly it's slowing down. What would really help experimentally is to observe how high it goes, because that's a little bit tricky to just guess. And so when you make a measurement of how high it goes, you observe that it goes almost to the starting height, not quite. Okay, and how about if the down ramp is steep and the up ramp is shallow? Well, it goes further and further and further along that shallow ramp until it reaches basically the same height where it started. Any configuration you can think of, shallow versus steep, long versus short, the marble will try by itself to go back up to the same height as where it started from. Okay, so this is interesting. We're discovering something universal, and you're beginning to wonder, is this some principle of nature? Is there something fundamental about this? So the fact that you can change the angles around all you want, and you can change the marbles around all you want, it seems like we're on to something that's a little bit more than just the description of motion. Right? We're on to something which is telling us about the reasons. So Galileo's thinking about this, and he says, there seems to be some rule here. What would happen if I roll the marble down the ramp and the angle, the up angle, is very, very shallow? So he's thinking to himself, well, it's going to have to go a really long way, because if it's a shallow angle, it's going to have to go a long way before it reaches the original height. What if I take the limit? What if I take the limit of no angle at all? Hey, you got a marble rolling down the ramp, it reaches the flats, and then there is no uphill at all, but we could call that an uphill of zero angle. And what Galileo realizes is, oh, holy smokes, what's going to happen is it's going to keep on going forever because it's trying to get up to its original height. That's what it always does. And in this one case, we're frustrating that little marble, and it's just going to keep rolling and rolling and rolling. Okay, this may seem obvious, but it's not at all obvious in Galileo's time. It's a direct contradiction, remember, to Aristotle, who says, objects want to be at rest. That's their natural state. And so what Galileo is saying is that if you don't have an uphill or a downhill, if you just let the marble do its own thing, and in particular, of course, you've got to get rid of friction, then the marble will continue in a straight line forever at a constant speed. Now, that friction part of the story was part of Galileo's genius. He's mucking around trying to reduce friction. He notices that the less friction he's got, the closer the marble gets to reaching its original height. So he takes that last step. That's the thought experiment, where you can't absolutely, completely eliminate friction in real life, but you can imagine what would happen if. And that is a huge step, because as soon as you ask what would happen if there was no friction, and you say, seems like an object in motion would remain in motion, now you've discovered that there's this big idea that doesn't have to do with the object. It's a principle of physics. It's Galileo's principle of inertia. Principle of inertia says an object in motion, in the absence of other forces trying to speed it up or slowing down, in the absence of forces, an object in motion will remain in motion forever. Straight line, same speed, forever. So this is the beginning of a new way of thinking about the world. It is dynamics. Okay, it's just at the fringe of a new kind of physics. And so you have to concede that friction is present in real life and gravity is present in real life and ask yourself, yes, but what's the intrinsic nature of motion? And so this is the principle of inertia. The intrinsic nature of motion is for objects to continue. Aristotle doesn't get this, right? Aristotle is saying, no, it depends on the object, and objects have desires or at least some properties. And this is much broader. This is much general, and of course, it's experimentally verifiable, which Aristotle's were not. So Galileo is beginning to see a universality here. And it's very simple, it's very regular, and it's very predictable. And here's the key, which we're going to have to come back to in future lectures. That marble on the flat ramp, you don't have to ask, what do you have to do to keep it going? Right? That was Aristotle's question. What is required to keep an object in motion? Absolutely nothing is required. Objects in motion will remain in motion spontaneously. That's the nature of the physical world. So these ideas, they arise with marbles, but they're going to be true for, you name it, baseballs, rocket ships, planets orbiting the sun, atoms inside of materials. Right? This is really cool because you will no longer need to invoke some mystical story about the planets. Right? Why does the planet go around the sun, or why does the sun go around the earth? This is still in debate in Galileo's time. But either question, you would have to be sort of wondering, well, what would make it? And the motion of planets just makes very little sense. If you don't have this principle of inertia, that the objects will want to continue in their motion. Now, the planets are not going in a straight line, so we're going to have to think about that. Why do they go in a circle? But we don't have to invoke angels or God, and of course, that's quite heretical in the 15 and 1600s, and it's part of what got Galileo into a lot of trouble with the church. This inertia principle is critical because it's going to connect the motion of marbles to the motion of planets and the motion of everything. There's one little point that I want to make just to wrap this up about terminology. So I've been trying to be careful about operational definitions. I've been a little bit sloppy about speed and velocity. In English, those are completely synonymous. Your car has a speed of 55 miles an hour. You could probably, although you wouldn't, you could say it's got a velocity at 55 miles. Did I say that right? 55 miles per hour. So there is a distinction to a physicist between speed and velocity, and at the moment it's not all that big of a deal. But velocity carries with it an extra piece of information. If I say my car is going 55 miles per hour, I need to tell you something else for you to really visualize my automobile. I have to say north or southeast. I have to tell you not just how fast I'm going, but also which way I'm going in order for you to know how I'm moving. Kinematics requires that you know, by my description, what the motion is. So when you're talking about velocity, you're talking not just about the magnitude or strength, the speed, the how many miles per hour, but you're also talking about which way. So Galileo's principle of inertia says that when there are no forces, an object in motion will have a constant velocity. I'm done, right? A constant velocity means same speed and same direction forever. So, okay, this may seem like a technical point right now, and we'll come back and see when we're looking at circular motion, where objects are changing in the direction that they're traveling, that this is in fact an important idea. So it just fits in here, and we'll come back to it. But let me wrap up this lecture. Galileo has taught us a lot of wonderful things about the world just by looking at marbles rolling down a ramp. He's shown us in many ways how wrong Aristotle was, not just about his answers to questions, but the way he was thinking about the questions. His inertia principle is telling us that there's something very deep and important here, and there's a new question to ask. Not what keeps something in motion. The more important question would be, what would change the motion?